Was Gautama Buddha the only Sammasambuddha Buddha who established the Bhikkhuni Sangha? Did the previous Buddha establish the Bhikkhuni order? I don't really know what the previous Buddha did. Not sure, I don't think it's said anywhere. Maybe it does say that maybe it's some kind of a scripture somewhere that I haven't read, because a lot of things are said in kind of modern commentaries and that sort of thing. But I think it's very likely that all Buddhas would have established Bhikkhunis as well as Buddha Bhikkhus. Because it is the purpose of the Sangha is to help people get enlightened. And if you don't have it for half the population, you're missing an opportunity. Yeah? So it's kind of bad news. It's something that was there for everyone, probably all the Buddhas. So I can't say that for certain, but that would be my guess. Is it the case that would shorten the Buddha dispensation? Is this really true? And it's a controversial question, a controversial subject, and it's very hard to know what exactly happens 2,500 years ago. You're trying to reconstruct something using the text that we have now that is so ancient. There's very a lot of uncertainty in that. What we do know is you can look at all the various sayings of the Buddha in the suttas, and a lot of those sayings of the Buddha in the suttas are very positive about the bhikkhunis. Yeah, it talks about the bhikkhunis in a very positive way, saying that the Sangha will not be Buddhism will not be complete without bhikkhunis. Yeah? We need bhikkhunis to have a sense of completion. If we don't have them, then as long as they haven't been established well, properly, so they're able to teach, they're able to practice in the right way, they become strong and powerful. It says in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, until that point, I will not take Parinibbana. Yeah? So he is very positive about the bhikkhunis in this sense. Another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 73 called the Mahavachagotta Sutta, he says to Vachagotta, he says that Vachagotta asks him, you know, do you have any arahant monks? Do you have any arahant bhikkhunis? And the Buddha says, well, you know, 500 or whatever arahant bhikkhunis. And then Vachagotta says, well, if it hadn't been for the fact that you had all these arahant bhikkhunis, then your dispensation, the Dhamma, wouldn't have been complete. Yeah? Same argument again, the idea that Buddhism is only complete and fulfilled if you have both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, both male and female sangha. And this is something you see in a number of places in the suttas, and it seems to go very much against this idea that the bhikkhuni sangha will shorten the life of the Dhamma. It seems to be saying the exact opposite. Yeah? If you haven't got bhikkhunis, it isn't complete. So I often ask myself, which one is the real Buddha? Is the real Buddha the one who says good things about the Bhikkhuni Sangha? Or is the real Buddha the one who says it will shorten the lifespan with 500 years or whatever? Which one is actually correct? And if you look at the context, this particular idea that, you know, the Buddha prophesied that the Bhikkhuni Sangha will decline the lifespan of the Dhamma by 500 years, it is in the Vinaya, and a lot of the material in the Vinaya is later than the suttas. It came afterwards. Because it became afterwards, I think it's much more likely that the material we find in the suttas are more likely to be the original word of the Buddha, not what you find in the Vinaya. So I would say that the positive thing the Buddha has to say about the beginning is much more likely to be true and real, rather than this idea that the lifespan is cut short by 500 years. The other thing about the Buddha, if you read the suttas, it's very rare for the Buddha to prophesize about the future. Yeah? He doesn't really say things about the future. Yeah? That's not the way he operates. There's a couple of exceptions to that. This is one of those exceptions. Another exception is where he prophesies that the Venerable Ananda will become an arahant before he passes away. Yeah? And that's what happens at the first council, that he becomes an arahant shortly before that, Venerable Ananda. But apart from that, he doesn't really prophesize very much. He just looks into the future and trying to say things. So this here is a little bit out of character. It's not the way the Buddha normally deals with things and does things.
So, and also there are some, lots of, a few discrepancies. This whole story, this is the story around when Mahaprajapati Gautami, yeah, you remember Mahaprajapati Gautami, yeah, the most famous nun, and who would have been first, the Buddha's foster mother, and she was a Dhyana, another teacher, and that whole story around that, which includes this particular prediction, varies quite a bit in the different recensions we have. So there may have been some changes there, there have been some corruptions there. We don't really know exactly what happened. And if the Buddha didn't want, it's a strange thing, yeah, you establish the Bhikkhu Sangha, and straight away afterward you say, well, now the Dhamma will last 500 years less. Strange. What did the Buddha say? It's like he's undermining his own creation. He just started the Bhikkhu Sangha. It doesn't hang together very well. So I must admit, I have my strong doubts that this is the Buddha ever said this. I really don't think it's true. And that's the way I look at it. There's so many positive statements about the Bhikkhunis and the Pinna Sangha in the suttas, and I prefer to believe that this is the real Buddha and the way the Buddha taught things. Okay. Dear Ajahn, please elaborate on anatta, non-self. I lost my sense of self and life's purpose recently after being coerced into early retirement from my journalistic profession of 24 years. I'm single and my parents have passed away. I feel lost. Yes, that's a good point. You know, I can understand that, and I can understand why people are, you know, this is difficult for people when these things happen. Let me first start off with number. These are two slightly different things, yeah? Losing your sense of self in that way is one thing, but understanding anatta is something else. When you understand, when you become enlightened, you don't feel lost, you don't feel lost in that way, yeah? You feel happy. So that's the good news. We start with the good news. So what does anatta mean? And it just means, as I mentioned before, it is kind of a teaching of the Buddha that was used in to counter the idea that existed in India at that time. At that time in India you had the Brahmanical teaching, the Upanishads, the Vedas, and these sort of things. And they had this idea of an atta, a self, yeah? A permanent entity inside of us, like a soul that was always there, solid. Nothing could happen to it. And when you died, that soul kind of went and joined with Brahma, and then you lived with Brahma happily ever after. Yeah? The cosmic self, we're all one and happily ever after, one big family, happily ever after. Yeah? And this is the idea of a self, this kind of essence of a human being. Yeah? And we all feel a little bit like that. Yeah? If you look inside of yourself, you feel real in a certain way. Yeah? This is me. Yeah? This is how I feel. If you look back to your childhood, as you kind of think of there's something there which was there when you were a child and is still there now, kind of going through all of this. And this gives you a sense that there is a real human side. But the insight into non-self, it shatters that illusion. And it makes it clear that what we are, this waves, or we are this kind of things always changing, always moving, nothing permanent in there at all. Is that scary? No, it is not scary at all. Why is it not scary? And the way to think about this is to look at your meditation practice. Sometimes your meditation will be going quite nice and become quite peaceful. Sometimes it does with the other space. Sometimes the meditation is terrible. Sometimes it's nice. But when your meditation is going nice, your mind calms down and you don't think so much anymore. You feel at ease, you feel relaxed. It feels good, yeah, you know what I mean? It feels nice when finally things come together and you feel a little bit peaceful. But what you will notice is that when you feel really peaceful, that your mind isn't kind of talking to you all the time, then actually what is happening there is your ego is less, your sense of self is reduced. Because what is it that does all the talking? What does all the talking is the sense of self. Yeah, we're thinking about the future, the past, trying to control, trying to solve problems, we're talking about to ourselves or whatever it is. It's the sense of self that does that. But when the sense of self falls away, when it becomes less, you become peaceful inside. You feel better, for goodness sake. Yeah? And this shows you what a burden the sense of self actually is. The less there is of a sense of self, the more happy you feel, the more at ease you feel, the more relaxed you feel, the better you feel about yourself. So this is kind of the good news. It is not scary. The way to understand that is precisely this way. Look at the results in the meditation practice, and then you will start to see that the reduction of the sense of self, the reduction of the ego, is a very positive experience. The more you reduce the ego, the more bliss you feel. And after a while, kind of the penny drops, you think, yeah, okay, now I see why non-self is a good thing. But for one day, it goes so deep that the sense of self is obliterated once and for all, and it never returns again. And that is, of course, the idea of stream entry, first of all, and full awakening later on. So non-self is good news. Don't be afraid of non-self. Yeah? Non-self is great. Self is bad news. Non-self is good news. So, you lost your sense of self and life's purpose after being coerced into early retirement. I don't know, that is your question. Yeah. So, what you have to do is you have to repurpose your life. Yeah? So, and this is, because it's not nice to feel lost. It is not nice to feel that you haven't got any purpose in life. But there are so many pretty things you can do with your life now that you are free, yeah, of that job or whatever it is. One of the people who was a very strong person here in the media before, life painting, but they didn't want to go to life painting, yeah. She's now done that, putting down a monastery, that's the Masala monastery there. Yeah. Very nice, very nice. So very, very good. She also had a profession, she was a, worked for the medical company before she became a nun. And one day she was laid off, yeah, because they didn't need her anymore. And you know what she said when she was laid off? Then, yay, hooray, I'm laid off, yeah, no more work. Now I can spend all my time doing Dhamma stuff instead. This is what she was thinking. She was still thinking, oh no, I've been fired, I've been laid off, I don't have a job anymore. The exact opposite reaction. What a wonderful opportunity it is to be laid off. But now I can spend my time doing good activities, good Dhamma things instead. That was her kind of feeling about that. So now that you have retired, it's a wonderful opportunity to do volunteer work, for example. Do volunteer work for the BGM. Yeah, Robin? Yeah. Come and do some volunteer work for the BGM. It's a wonderful opportunity. Go out in society. See if there are some groups that you can help out with. Maybe there are some groups that support poor people, that sort of thing. See if you can volunteer in these kinds of positions. Yeah? Have compassion for the world. See how people are often suffering, how people are much worse off than you are. And when you do that, you can open up your heart to others. The opportunity to listen to more Dhamma talks, to understand the suttas, understand the Buddha in a much deeper way. Now you can listen to a Dhamma talk every day, yeah, at least, if you want to. Get into the suttas, start reading the Majjhima Nikaya, the Digha Nikaya, start to understand these things. Take your meditation a bit more seriously. Try to meditate. It doesn't have to be much, but meditate a little bit every day, maybe when you wake up. All of these things are not possible. Go on retreats occasionally, yeah? If you can afford it. I know it's sometimes can be expensive, but actually these days you have quite cheap flights to Perth even. Come down to Dharma Grove, yeah? Take a nice mindful meditation retreat, come down to Brown Street retreat, and see if you can do that. Or come even on a self-retreat, if you are a member of the BGM, and you get kind of stamped by a copy that you are a meditator, yeah? And we will probably let you in straight, let me down there. You just help retreat, that's how I grow. Just enjoy yourself down there. Just open up the possibilities. Look at what is possible. Suddenly, all these other things that you haven't had time to do before now become possible. So, don't despair. Just think, yes, your life feels a bit empty right now, but gradually you learn to fit it up again with good things. Ask some of the other people who are retired. Is everyone else? I'm sure there must be retired people in the BGF, yeah? Ask some of the other people who are retired in the BGF, and ask them, what do you guys do? Maybe they say, oh, maybe they have other things, but, you know, ask them what is a positive, good way of filling your time in this way, so as to do a contribution to society and help yourself by being compassionate and doing all these kind of things, and see how that gradually kind of enriches your life, rather than feeling empty and a lack of sense of self. After a while, you start to feel enriched instead. And you start to see what a wonderful thing it is that you got retired, yeah? Not fired, retired, as I should say. What a wonderful thing that is to be retired. And now it looks terrible, down the line, boy, you're going to be so happy about it. Okay. Okay, how to be less serious in life? Do I need to figure out why I'm too serious? Because sometimes it doesn't need to know why. Thank you. Do you need to know why? You don't really need to know why. Because usually the reason why is just the conditioning from the past. Yeah, the conditioning has put you into this position to become a serious person. It's just the way it is. It doesn't matter. Very often people ask, why is this happening to me? Yeah, I was fine on my job, I got retired, my partner left me. Why? I don't know why. Is it karma? Did I do something bad in the past? Forget about all that. It doesn't matter. Why? Yeah, this is human life. This is what you can expect. Sometimes our partners leave us, sometimes we get fired, sometimes we get retired, sometimes we die. Yeah? So bang, you're dead. Your heart stops. And my heart is going to be released. Okay. So it means we can carry on with the retreat. So don't worry so much about the whys. The whys is not what matters. Instead, ask yourself, how can you be more lighthearted? Yeah? Start just joking around a bit more, just kind of do little funny things, and just kind of jump up and down a little bit, Do things that are completely silly, are completely meaningless. And when you do things that are completely silly, it makes you take yourself less serious and life less seriously. This is one of the reasons I'm wrong. This is the kangaroo jumping meditation, Because if you try the kangaroo jumping, you feel so stupid, Because you're jumping around like a kangaroo, and it feels this is really, really silly, And it's very hard to be serious after that. So you have a good laugh when you do the kangaroo jumping meditation. And it makes life lighter, it makes life kind of more bearable when you are a bit silly, you just laugh at things, stupid things in life. And it's a very good way of being, So just take it gradually. Listen to nice talks that aren't funny. Just kind of gradually learn how to enjoy yourself in this way. And I'm sure you will, if you really want to, you will find a way. Okay. Number one, why weren't the suttas written down during the Buddha's lifetime? Time, but until later. The reason was because there was no writing at the Buddha's time. And there may have been a little bit of writing used, but it was used most probably then only for economic purposes and that sort of thing. But most likely there was no writing at the time of the Buddha. And especially the way that religious texts were passed down, they were always passed down orally. So you had the Brahmanical texts, the Vedas, that had already been passed down for thousands of years already at that time, at least 1,000 years. To oral means, and they had developed culture that was very, very skilled at passing things down orally. So it was done with incredible precision. They knew how to do this. The oral technology, was very kind of good in those days. A very sophisticated way of passing things down orally over long periods of time. So that is really why. Can you clarify Mara? Is Mara real or only based on Indian gods? Mara, Mara in the suttas, you have seen Mara all the time. And Mara is always a pain in the neck, it's always doing terrible things, making life difficult for people. Coming to the Buddha and saying, Buddha, please die, we don't want to have you around anymore. You're too nice, making life too, people, I want to control people, you're getting in my way, that sort of thing, that's Mara. Well, Mara also occurs in the Bhikkhuni Samyutta. In the Bhikkhuni Samyutta, it's all about the Bhikkhuni, and they have their verses, and they always converse with Mara. And Mara goes, you are just a woman, what do you think? You can't do anything good. And the Bhikkhuni's reply in verse, get lost, Mara, or something like that. And that's quite nice, and then Mara just kind of disappears afterwards. And of course, in those days, especially in Indian society at that time, the status of women was quite low. This is one of the reasons why it was quite revolutionary for the Buddha to allow women to go forth and become bhikkhunis. Because it wasn't really, it wasn't common at that time. Usually women had a fairly low status in society. So because of they have a low status, sometimes you don't feel so confident about yourself. It's just a natural consequence of having low status. So because of that, women perhaps weren't so confident. So the Mara, you know, Mara here is really, in this case, it's not really a real person, I think. Much more, it's like the psychology. Yeah, you doubt yourself. Can I really do this? If you don't feel confident about yourself, you doubt yourself. Am I able to do this? No. I mean, you know, especially if you were a woman and perhaps you had low, you know, you didn't, especially if you were perhaps a woman from a low caste and you didn't have much education and all of these kind of things. You had good reasons maybe, for maybe not good reasons, but it was natural that you would doubt yourself. And in these cases, Mara is just the psychology of human beings. The psychology when we are trapped by certain things, whether it's self-doubt or it's defilements or whatever it is that traps us. This is what Mara very often represents. And that is the main thing in the suttas. Mara representing this, the sidetrack from the path of Buddhism. The defilement, especially sensuality. Mara is kind of the god of sensuality, yeah? So, yeah, well, you could go get married, yeah? You're wasting your time with the robes. You could enjoy yourself in lay life. This is Mara speaking, yeah? And this is the kind. This is the main thing about Mara in the suttas, is this psychological thing that comes like a devil, a tempter, tempting us in a different way, in a different path. But sometimes it seems also that Mara is more like a real god in the suttas, and whether those passages are how they are to be understood, whether that's just something that has been inherited from the Brahmanical religion, or whether Mara should actually be understood as a real deity in those cases, I don't really know. I think it's quite likely that those, it's quite possible that those things may be later, been added later on, and I don't think they are so important actually. I would just forget about those and just see them as a quaint little thing in the suttas. The most important thing is that Mara as being a metaphor for defilement, a metaphor for temptation, drawing us away from the path. That is by far the most important one. Number three, can you explain Dutanga, the 13 ascetic practices? How should we practice them? Dutanga, this is found in the Visuddhimagga, the 13 Dutangas, sometimes also found in the suttas. But only some of them are found in the suttas, and most of them are found in the Visuddhimagga. Most of these Dutanga are not important. Yeah, they are not found a lot in the sutta, they are quite rare. We have the Nesantrika Dutanga. Nesantrika means you're always sitting. It's only found twice in the entire Sutta Pitaka, in very obscure places. So because of that, I wouldn't really recommend that kind of practice. It's just too ascetic. If you want to do ascetic practices, I would recommend to do that. I can imagine who asked this question. But if you want to do ascetic practices, I would recommend that do that only after you have some good meditation experiences, when the meditation is quite stable. Because if you do ascetic practices before that, you're very likely to just tire out your mind and to kind of find a lot of suffering in life, make life very difficult for yourself. Some of the ascetic practices are not so hard, like the three-row practice is okay, especially if you live in a reasonable climate. So some of them can be done, but many of them go too far, and I would not recommend them unless there are special, you know, special reasons why you should use them. Generally speaking, find that balance where your body is comfortable. That is by far the most important thing. Be comfortable, be at ease. Don't get onto the side of torturing yourself. Also, don't indulge. Find the middle way. When you find that middle way, that is where you are on the right track. If you do the Dutangas, but you don't torture yourself, you find it useful, then it is okay. If you find it becomes a burden, that is when I would not do it. And that is how I would go about those things. But remember, generally speaking, the Buddha doesn't talk about the Dutangas very much at all. They are very optional. And the middle way is really the path and where it is at. That is what you should all be aiming for. Maybe once your meditation is going really well, we can kind of type back those things in the middle. But make sure you get some happiness in your life before you move on to some of these harder practices. Okay, any more questions, sir? Anybody want to ask anything else, sir? We haven't. Yeah. Are you going to change the schedule tomorrow afternoon then? Yeah, already then? Yeah, okay, very good. Yeah. We're going to change the schedule a little bit in the afternoon, so that's going to be nice early. Yeah. Is that a good idea? Even out early then? Yeah? It's quite late, it's like 7, isn't it? Yeah. We're going to tighten it up a little bit, so it will be a little bit different, and then hopefully that will work out. Please give us feedback on the schedule, yeah? If you think of anything that can be better, yeah? We're going to shorten the meditation a little bit, because I noticed a couple of people left through the meditation, I thought, whoa, okay. It's too scary, 45 minutes, maybe a long time if you're at the beginning. I can understand that. So, and we will do more meditation instead of doing the meditation retreat afterwards. So, and then we will hopefully still have a good program. Okay, so we'll just pay respect to the Buddha and the Sangha before we leave
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅgho.